Talkers.
Welcome to Speak and Destroy, Episode 17. I'm your host, Ryan J. Downey. Speak and Destroy is a podcast about all things Metallica. My guest this episode is Stavros Giannopoulos. Stavros is guitarist and co-vocalist of one of my favorite bands, The Atlas Moth, a blackened, sludge-infused, psychedelic metal band from Chicago with a trio of critically acclaimed albums that led up to their fourth and best full-length record, Coma Noir. If you're a fan of Gojira, you may have caught The Atlas Moth on tour with them across the United States just a couple of years ago. In a 4K review, Kerrang praised their new album for its sludgy doom, gigantic spaciness, sprawling post-metal odysseys, gnashing riffs, and mixture of the epic and abrasive, comparing them favorably to like-minded bands Neurosis and Cult of Luna. Stavros was also a member of the black metal supergroup Twilight, alongside Rest of Leviathan, Blake Judd of Noctmystium, and Imperial of Krieg, tastemaking producer Sanford Parker, whose albums regularly end up in the year-end lists in Decibel magazine, and indie rock legend Thurston Moore. Upon joining Twilight, the Sonic Youth leader declared, "We're not coming together to make music. We're joining forces to destroy all rational thought." Stavros spreads his creative wings even further as part of Chrome Waves, a shoegazing post-black metal project spearheaded by Jeff Wilson of Wolfhammer, Abigail Williams, and Noctmystium, among other bands. My good friend and former bandmate, the late great Jason McCash, was a touring member of Chrome Waves. The band also includes another Noctmystium alum, drummer Iron Bob Fouts, who played with McCash and I in Burn It Down before the pair reunited in The Gates of Slumber, one of my favorite bands of all time. It was Bob who first introduced me to Stavros, rightly assuming we'd become fast friends, and expertly matchmaking us as fellow Metallica superfans. Yes, Stavros is a person of stature in the cred-soaked circles followed by Pitchfork, Stereo Gum, and Brooklyn Vegan, but he loves Metallica, including, and in some ways especially, Load and Reload. As we discuss in this episode, Stavros was born on Cliff Burton's birthday, February 10th, in 1983, the year Kill 'Em All was released. His first cassette was a copy of Injustice for All, and his first concert was Metallica when he was just 5 years old. He also possesses the most extensive collection of rare Metallica recordings of anyone that I know. Before we jump into this episode, have a listen to The Atlas Moth to get a feel of what he's all about. The more stripped-down version of the band heard on Coma Noir, their first album with Prosthetic Records, definitely has some elements of the band that we love the most here at Speak and Destroy. Here's The Atlas Moth with Galactic Brain.
We'll be right back.
hope you enjoyed that even half as much as I did. So here it is, my conversation with Stavros of the Atlas Moth. This is Speak and Destroy. Tell me about young Stavros and your entry point to music and eventually heavy music.
Well, there was no entry point to music without heavy music, oddly enough. It was what the music was. My parents didn't listen to music, really. Was not a thing. My brother didn't listen to music at all, really. And my sister was, well, she's 11 years older than me, and I was born in 83. So when I was 5, she was 16, and that was 1988. And in a way to get back at my brother, who she did not get along with, she got me a Walkman and a cassette version of And Justice for All for my 5th birthday. And then, shortly thereafter that, possibly before it, obviously my memory is a little shady around this time frame, but they had an extra ticket to Metallica, and I believe it was The Cult, at the UIC Pavilion in Chicago. And she begged my mom to let her take me. So she took me when I was 5 to go see the Justice tour. So that was the beginning, man.
Wow. So you, first of all, you were born the same year as the first Metallica record was released.
Not only the same year, but the same day as Cliff Burton.
Oh, wow.
I'm a Metallica baby.
which happy recent birthday. So you have...
Yes, absolutely.
So you have the same birthday as Cliff Burton. You were born the same year as the first Metallica album, and your first concert at age 5 was Metallica, and your first record was Metallica.
Yes. Yeah, I'm pure Metallica. This is also the reason why I won't let anybody call me a hipster, right? You know, because like I saw Metallica in the 80s. You know, so you can't call me a hipster ever. I'm more metal than anybody, as far as I'm concerned.
Well, I mean, and this explains so much about our friendship.
From the jump.
Yeah.
I do recall when Bob Fosse initially told me to get a hold of you that he's like, yo, he's as big of a Metallica dork as you are. So I was like, oh, well, that's fine then, you know?
Yeah, we had Bob and I had many a friendly verbal sparring match about 90s Metallica versus 90s Slayer.
Yeah, well, you know, that is a thing.
Oh, all I know is Metallica never took Ultra Spank on tour, just saying.
No, they didn't, you know, but they did use a pedal steel, which is, you know, there's a couple things. The Hurdy-Gurdy, I don't know.
The Hurdy-Gurdy.
I love that song, though. Yeah. The Hurdy-Gurdy.
Oh, I know you love that song, and we're gonna get there.
Yeah, I hope we gotta get there. I have a couple of talking points.
So what do you remember about that first Metallica? We would have seen them almost on the same tour for the first time, because the first time I saw them was Monsters of Rock with Van Hagar, Scorpions, Dokken, and Kingdom Come. Metallica was 2nd of 5, and as I've told this story on this podcast before, but my buddy and I went in our Metallica shirts, stood with our middle fingers up for Kingdom Come, watched Metallica, and then went home.
Yeah, that's. I'm assuming this probably would have been a pretty similar thing, aside that Metallica was headlining.
Yeah, same record though, yeah.
Yeah, same record. Yeah, actually, was it 87 for Monsters of Rock? Or no, am I wrong? Was it 88?
I believe it was 88, but it was before the record had actually come out. So I remember... Right.
I have several bootlegs from that tour that I remember it being like first time they played Harvester of Sorrow or something.
Exactly.
Like that.
And that was really exciting for us because this was, you know, pre-internet, and also Metallica wasn't a band that radio cared about. So hearing Harvester of Sorrow live was the first time hearing that song, period. And that was insane when they're like, we're going to play a new song. And we're like, what?
Yeah, and it was also Harvester of Sorrow.
Exactly.
You know, which like I recall, the first time they played Fuel, I was there for, which isn't as nearly as cool. So there's that.
Hey, I've said this on the podcast before, too. Fuel is... you know, love it or hate it, it's great in a 2018 Metallica set list because there's this little word, dynamics. I sound like Donald Trump. There's a word, dynamics.
There's a word, dynamics. sounds like fake news to me. I don't know.
But yeah, it's great in that, you know, I was Alex Skolnick actually mentioned on the podcast that that wasn't a song he was really a fan of, you know, when it was released. And then when he saw the band semi-recently, he was like, wait, I really dig this song in the live setting. It really serves a great purpose here.
Yeah, you know what, in all honesty, it's a song that I really championed when it came out, because it was more of a heavy rocking song. That I didn't think at the time it was goofy. It's a little goofy now. It's also in a car commercial, which kind of bummed me out.
Well, and here's the thing, too, is, mechanics and Four Horsemen have been a topic of conversation on numerous episodes here, with Rob Flynn and then with David Ellefson, who, of course, is the bassist on the version of Mechanics we all know and love. And one of the things I always say is that Mechanics is the better song, and Four Horsemen has the better lyrics. But with that being said, you know, Hetfield wrote a car metaphor song, you know, a couple decades later. So
that's true.
You know, we can't really knock the. I mean, I guess Hetfield's isn't about sex; it's like literally about cars. But
yeah, it's totally about cars. Maybe booze.
Yeah,
you know, definitely cars.
Yeah,
I'll tell you what, man. We might be already just getting off topic, but regardless, I'm not a big fan lyrically of Kill 'Em All as a whole.
Yeah, what do you mean off topic? We're talking about Metallica. we're on topic,
technically we were talking about what I remember from my first concert.
Yes, don't worry. Yeah. We'll circle back.
I mean, it's kind of funny because I remember it was Hardwired when Hardwired came out. Everyone on the internet was sitting there being like, oh my God, these fucking lyrics are terrible. And I'm like, have you never heard Kill 'Em All? Like,
have you never heard No Life Till Leather gonna kick some ass tonight? Well, all right. Yeah.
Yeah. exactly. Like, in my leather and my spikes, you know, I'm gonna bang my head against the stage like I never did before. When I'm talking like Hetfield is ever like, you know, a lyrical powerhouse here, you know, like.
He literally says we are Metallica in a song.
Yeah, seriously, I mean, it's awful. You know, I actually, and this is one of my arguing points always about Load, was that I actually think that when you take away like Ain't My Bitch, of course, you know, Fuel, you know, like some of those, I'm gonna say these are some of those best lyrics, and they hold up. You
Absolutely.
Know, like, I mean, I think that like when you look back at the '80s, yeah, you know, like these like. Call the arms heavy metal militia type things are cool, you know, and they probably fit the time, you know, but like as far as aging, you know, you really can't.
Yeah, really they sound very dated. I mean, I mean obviously, you know, some of those similar metal anthems and specifically thrash metal anthems like Bonded by Blood by Exodus and Rattlehead by Megadeth. Those are awesomely cool in their own way. But then even just a couple years later when Exodus was literally doing the Toxic Waltz, like by that point, it was kind of like, this feels.
Yeah. You're a little walking the line there, you know? And like, you know, honestly though, like if someone that doesn't know anything about metal was like introduced to Metallica, I wouldn't necessarily go with Load, but I certainly wouldn't go with Kill 'Em All.
Interesting, because I think, there's an argument to be made for kind of starting with that blueprint, but yeah, Kill 'Em All had, you know, it's a record that I appreciate for its punkness. I mean, it's basically...
Sure, it's raw, it's awesome, you know, I mean, it's my least favorite of the first four.
Yeah, I mean, same here, and it's, least favorite of the first three, I would say. It's Motorhead meets Diamond Head through the prism of Southern California.
That's an intense, that's very on point too,
which is all awesome. That. You know, it's a bunch
great
of awesome
stuff,
things.
Yeah.
But yeah, it certainly doesn't even hint at what was to come in terms of how kind of epic and, you know, all the twists and turns they would take. So let's talk about that show. I mean, you're 5 years old. I mean, I saw Kenny Rogers and the Oak Ridge Boys when I was about that age. So
I had a pretty awesome, you know, first few concert experiences, you know, just because my sister was so much older and my parents were oddly so European, yet so very open to me experiencing new things, which I look back at as a blessing. But yeah, I recall being told to boo the cult, and I did. I remember my sister and her friend sharing a cigarette and her telling me to not tell mom, which I assume wasn't a cigarette now, my elder age. And I recall Doris falling.
Oh, wow.
And yeah. And I recall, you know, I mean, looking at James Hetfield in 1988, I mean, there's really no harder human being on the planet than that circa 87, 88 Hetfield. You know, the dude was incredibly larger than life, as I mean, the band in general were. You know, but I mean, like, I couldn't tell you how awesome they played. I mean, everything was amazing until you're like 20, you know. so, right. But, you know, like, I mean, I can actually recall the first time I was like, oh, wow, that band I went and saw was terrible. And like, it was, you know, it wasn't any time early on, you know, but I assumed that Metallica was fantastic. But yeah, I recall all that. I recall coming home a little bit later than my mother pleased I was, and I was in trouble for it. But other than that, you know. All was well, and it set me off on my path. You know, honestly, from that moment on, I was like, man, I think I want to play a guitar in a band.
Do you remember which band Newstead was representing for with his t-shirt?
Well, probably Metallica.
Yeah, it's like, I'm going to guess it was Metallica, Megadeth, yeah. Sacred Reich, pretty much one of those three.
that era.
Yeah.
I mean, the Misfits. Let's face facts here, right? I'm pretty sure that Metallica has had like some sort of clause in their bass player contracts that you must wear a Metallica shirt, and possibly the one's not selling well. You know, they're like, hey, you put on the basketball jersey. We're way behind on, way overstocked on those. Put that fucking thing on, you know?
Yeah.
And put on the Flaming Skull shirt. We haven't sold nearly enough of those yet. You know?
Like, you could make an argument that there's a Steve Harris-ness going on with that.
True. I mean, I'm curious more about the Trujillo scenario that's going on right now.
Maybe
he's also just super stoked that he's in Metallica. I mean, I would.
Hey, let's talk about this. You're the guest to have this conversation with, other than, you know, Robert Trujillo himself.
Sure.
I got to give him serious props, since we're talking specifically about fashion. In that, now the words Robert Trujillo and fashion, serious props, all in a sentence together, might sound insane.
Mind-blowing.
But yeah, hear me out.
I'm like, I almost got a headache from that, to be honest with you.
If you look at recent Metallica shows within the past year, let's say 2 years, Hardwired album cycle, the dude is rocking black t-shirts and fitted jeans, and he looks awesome.
Really? I haven't really looked, I don't think.
Yeah, and he's, you know, he's obviously very fit and looks cool and plays with such intensity and an amazing bass player and all that. Super nice guy. I've had the opportunity to meet him a handful of times. He's doing jeans and t-shirts, and he looks awesome, because I'm going to say that his initial entry into the band, I mean, look, the basketball jersey and shorts and the crab walking and all that looked great in Suicidal Tendencies. It looked interesting enough in Ozzy. It never fit in with Metallica to me.
Yeah, not once.
And that's to take nothing away from him as a performer, as a bassist, as a dude. I love him in Metallica in all of those senses. But the look, it just never felt right to me. And I got to say, in the last couple of years, he looks cool. Like, he fits. He fits. He looks great.
To be honest with you, I don't think I've looked into too much in the last couple of years. You know, I haven't got a chance. There was like, I recall once Newstead was kicked out of the band, I was like, you know what? I'm never paying for a Metallica show again. You know, because bummed.
I suppose you could argue forced out, but he did quit the band. He wasn't actually...
Right, yeah. You could argue many things about it. Once he was gone, I was like, you know, I'm never paying to see a Metallica show again. I somehow or another wound up at every single Metallica show for the next couple of years, because people kept buying me tickets, or my best friend and I tickets. You know what I'm saying? It was like impossible. And somehow or another, that streak has ended. So I haven't seen them. You know, they played Soldier Field in Chicago. It is such a giant pain in the ass to do that. So yeah, I haven't got a chance to see them the last couple of years, and I admittedly haven't been YouTubing much of their stuff from the Hardwired tour. Always look up a set list.
You should. Yeah, I would recommend checking that out. I mean, and they put up on the regular. I mean, it seems like daily, actually. I mean, they've always put up their entire shows as MP3s. But they've also, in recent years, been putting up a song or two from every show, Pro Shot. multi-camera angle.
Oh, that's pretty rad.
Pro sound, yeah. And they've also, something they've started doing, which I appreciate, you know, for a long time they've been putting up their rehearsal room stuff, like little montages and clips. But lately they've been using audio. They have like a soundboard in the room, and they've been doing soundboard audio. So you hear kind of this raw, them shooting the shit and riffing and playing, you know, Slayer licks or whatever. But then when they actually break into rehearsing a full song, you get soundboard audio, and it sounds really good.
See, you know, that's like the one thing I feel like every, no matter how you feel about Metallica nowadays and present day or whatever, I think you have to give them so many props for how much they give their fans. You know, like, not only do they have a fan base that is rabid and that wants more, 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 they give it to you. And I'll tell you what, if I was the same way I was when I was 13, collecting, you know, literally trading cassette copy bootlegs and VHS copy bootlegs on like primitive AOL internet to people I'd never even met. If I was that kid in this day and age, I would be going nuts.
I have to say, one of the more impressive things for listeners to understand about you is you have an extensive Metallica collection.
It's out of hand, man. I still have it. I can't even bear to like get rid of it. It's a crazy.
And you have, and you had so much stuff that you had digitized that when we first were getting to know each other, I guess, I don't know, 10 years ago or something, I was hitting you up. Some friends, you're like, hey, give me everything you have. In your case, I had to literally cherry pick because it was like,
insane.
You're not going to drop off a terabyte. So,
yeah, I mean, at the time, I don't even think I could send you a terabyte. The internet was up on that yet, you know? Like,
exactly.
I mean, that's literally where it's at. I mean, I it's funny, man. Everyone used to call me in high school. They used to call me either one of two things, and it was either Metallica Steve or Bootleg Steve because I would have – I don't know, like, how I even got into it initially, but, like, back in the day, you know, anybody old enough to recall, there was these, you know, members.aol.com/whatever-your-name-was, right?
Yeah.
And you could build a website. Somehow or another, I stumbled across this dude that had cassette bootlegs. And basically what it was, you know, you could send them double the amount of VHS tapes or cassette tapes, because there's this pre-CDR here. You could, you know, so say if he had a cassette bootleg of Metallica that took up three cassettes, I would send him six and he would send me back three with them copied, you know, and same with VHS. So, you know, like I have literally mountains and mountains of pretty rare stuff, actually. I don't know how available most of it is on the internet, but I think I'm only missing one full show from Cliff Amahl VHS wise.
Wow.
Which, from what I know, it was never circulated. You know, I mean, I've had the first Cliff show and the last Cliff show for years. All sorts of stuff, man. Like, and in all honesty, with these new box sets coming out, like, there's definitely been some hankering for me to replace some of my things. You know?
Right. Now that you have the most sourced. But, you know, what's interesting is, I understand as a fan for a long time now that Lars has been, in addition to the many, many roles that he plays in Metallica, one of his roles is he's also like the historian, that he's the guy who maintains the archive and has the vaults, so to speak, with, you know, laminates and, you know, all this sort of memorabilia. But my impression, and I would love to dig in and find out more about the process of how they're putting these box sets together, but my understanding is they're crowdsourcing and chasing things down. You know, I saw that they even had kind of put out the call like, hey, were you at any of these shows and this and that? And it's exciting to me the further we get in the process, because obviously when they're doing Kill 'Em All or even Ride the Lightning, they're going to be limited in the amount of material that survived or that they have access to. Whereas
right, absolutely.
The further we get, the more stuff there's going to be, you know, and I think you and I are in that unique and specific fan base that's going to be excited about the Load and Reload box sets. To see what gets unearthed there, and you know, and given how much they've always given to their fans, I'm curious to know what's out there that they haven't mined, you know, because we have, you and I, fans like you and I, we have demos that were put out as B-sides. We have
totally, yeah. Or I mean, I don't even know how they were even put out. Some of them, there's been a ton that's been, I don't even know how I got them, or how anybody else got them. You know, they weren't on B-sides. I think I sent you some of those.
Yep.
You know, that worked out. You know, like there was some put out there, but there's a ton that wasn't. And you're right. I've thought about the exact same thing about as we go on, there is so much more material. I'd like to say that maybe I had something to do with the Money Will Roll Right In being included on the new puppet set, because I know Brian Liu, who goes by Umlaut.
Yes.
Yes, of course. Who doesn't know Brian Liu?
Murder in the Front Row. For our listeners who may not know, Brian Liu is an OG original, what was it, the Bay Bridge Militia, the old school Metallica ensemble kind of crew, entourage.
Basically,
guys.
If there's a photo taken of Hetfield or anybody in that Bay Area in 80, 81, 82, it was by Umlaut taking that photo.
And he put out a book, and he now works for Super 7 Toys, so he's responsible for, you know, the Misfits action figures, the King Diamond one they just announced. You know, a lot of those cool different toys have had it. You know, the Iron Maiden toys that are coming out. And I'm talking about, like, the cool retro reaction figures that are...
I had no idea he worked for Super 7. I know you and I have dorked out over reaction figures before, so that's really exciting stuff.
It's killer. Especially because, you know, it's like the pendulum swing with a lot of things where you get this, like, super perfected... you know, video games now look like real life, and then the Nintendo Classic comes out and everybody loses their mind for it. And I think action figures are the same way. Like, I'm not so interested in a McFarlane toy style, super realistic, you know, 1,000 points of articulation action figure these days. I'm more interested in those reaction figures that have that dumbed down retrograde
vibe,
you know, like that's the King Diamond figure I want, you know?
Right, absolutely. I mean, I collect different wrestling, or I collect wrestling figures, so a little bit different. But even at the same time, I like the retro looking ones, you know. So like, I'm with you on that.
Hey, I'm gonna have Chris Jericho on the podcast pretty soon. So speaking of wrestling,
this is excellent segue here, my friend. I have an amazing Chris Jericho story involving Metallica. So
he does a great Lars impression, which I'm looking forward to having him.
I can't wait to hear that. I've actually been meaning to catch him. Obviously, we just signed with Prosthetic Records, and Steve Jost is our A&R guy. Who, once again, people who don't know, Steve Jost is quite the man in the metal world. He also signed Fozzy, and I've been meaning to get a whole. I've been dying for that time where I get to meet Chris Jericho, so I can bring this up. 1998 on the Reload tour, I was front row, and I had just gone to like three shows in a row.
And you're like 15 at this time, right? So you were in the Metallica fan club in the 90s.
Yeah, I was in there since I was like 11. I was in the front row, and let's go. Sorry, everyone just walked in the room here. Scott Kelly's fucking with me right now. We're talking about Metallica right now. I'll be down in there a little bit. Yeah, sorry. So anyway, 1998. It's Jerry Cantrell, Days of the New Metallica. Right, I'm in the front row.
Burn It Down was the local opener on that show in Indianapolis. Go on. and by local opener, I mean played in this little walkway between the gate and where the stage was.
That was in Noblesville, Indiana.
Yes, I was there. And they said, "Well, that's amazing." And they said,
"I was there."
You walked right by Fouts and I as you came in, and we. They told us to just play for 2 hours as people were coming in the door.
Play just a quick 2 hour set.
At that time we had a 7-inch. So
yeah, also that was the problem.
We did like five or six songs, and our songs were like 2.5 minutes. So we did like five or six songs and a cover literally over and over and over and over. We just kept playing the same songs over and over.
It sounds awful, but I would have done it.
Yeah. Oh yeah. And then I just got to every time we did a bio, I just put, you know, Metallica on the list of bands we'd played with.
Of course. So we were there. I was in the front row. And at this point, you know, like I'd like to think that all the guys in Metallica had kind of noticed me. Being in the front row 3 days in a row. So I'm standing there at the set ends. Hetfield walks over towards me and he gives me a wink. And oh, mind you, right after Metallica started, in between the front row, the guardrail and the stage, out walks Chris Jericho. So I'm sitting there like, holy shit, Chris Jericho is like 5 feet in front of me. You know, just me, guardrail, Chris Jericho, stage, Metallica. Whoa, what a crazy, what's going on here, you know? So I am sitting there, encore ends, they're just throwing out picks, Hetfield walks over, he winks at me, he throws me a pick, and it bounces off the palm of my hand.
Oh, shit.
And it falls in between the guardrail and the stage right in front of Jericho. So I go, hey, Jericho, help me out, man. Give me my pick. He looks at me. He looks at the pick. He looks back at me, shrugs, and grabs the pick and throws it in his pocket. And I'm like, that bastard.
No so way. By the way, this is not where I thought the story was going to go.
Right. And that's where it went. So I have been waiting for years to get my comeuppance on Chris Jericho. So dude, you can tell him that he has made the list for me, and I'm coming for him.
You
it's going to happen.
You know what I should do is I should take this segment of this episode and play it for Jericho when
really
he's
like
on the podcast.
I would really like you to do that because he's made the list, my friend. He's going down.
You know,
I'm finding him.
Is it possible? Now I don't know much about wrestling. And I have lots of friends who are like yourself, who are massive fans.
Quite into it.
Correct me if I'm wrong, but Jericho was a heel, right?
So that's something that I'm a little... Well, he's gone back and forth, right? And I want to say at the time he was a heel.
I was going to say, so maybe he was in character.
So what I've been told is that he does always stay in character when he is a babyface or a heel. And now, as much as I love the commitment to the gimmick, I'm still holding that against him. He's one of my favorite wrestlers of all time. Never going to let that one go.
I mean,
I'm taking that one to my grave, man.
Nor should you. I mean, that's heartbreaking.
Yeah, it was quite the heel turn. I feel like I hit with a steel chair or something like that. It was crazy.
What a triumphant story that could have been had he picked it up and handed it to you.
Oh yeah, totally. But also, what a triumphant story as a heel to not and steal it from a 15-year-old chubby little kid with long hair, you know.
So I sidetracked you. We started talking about Brian Liu, who's also a future podcast guest.
Oh, he has to be. Yeah. Oh, so the reason I brought up Brian Liu, though, was because he had posted something on his Facebook about looking for stuff for the Master of Puppets box set. And I was like, yo, Brian, you got to include when the money rolls in, because I only have a shitty copy of that, and I really want a better version of it. And in turn, we got the demo, which I didn't have. I only had a live version at Rosie's, which is also included on there.
I was never aware that they had, you know, with my dense Metallica knowledge, I was unaware that that song had been covered by them until you gave it to me at whatever point that was.
Yeah, which was only a live version. And let me tell you, man, I'd like to think that my collection was pretty damn extensive. And I never even knew a recorded demo version of When the Money Rolls Right In was even a thing. So when I saw, I had to buy the box set just because my money isn't all that it could be. But I've listened to it all online, all that's available online on Spotify. And that was the first thing I went to. Like, I scrolled through it and I was like, holy shit. You know, so I was very excited to hear that.
You also gave me the first clean, good copies of the Ramones covers that I ever had. Because there was, you know... They had 53rd and 3rd, I think, was the one that kind of made the rounds. That might have been the one that was on the actual Ramones tribute, but they did several, which I think a lot of fans maybe don't realize, and I think they were all B-sides.
I think for Frantic, maybe?
Yeah, I think they were definitely Saint Anger era, and I want to say maybe Japan, which still an era where if something was a Japanese-only B-side, you had to go to Japan to get it.
Right, yeah, or like, you know, spend the $30 on a single.
Yeah.
Which I did. More often than not.
for a long time, I just had this crappy, I think it was a rip from YouTube that was all of them together, so they were all together on a single track, which is annoying. And then
YouTube, so I'm sure it sounds like shit.
Yeah, and I think you were the guy that actually hooked me up with the all five of them.
That sounds about right. I definitely had them. They're not my favorite, but I had them.
Well, you know what was my favorite, and of course it was eventually included in Garage Inc. But I had for a long time as a prized possession the Motor Headache, they called it, which is when they did Lemmy's 50th birthday party.
Oh, yeah.
And they played as the Lemmys, where they all dressed up as Lemmy and played a bunch of Metallica covers. Prior to that, in rehearsal, they recorded a bunch of Motorhead covers, and those were...
Yeah, the Motorheadache mess.
Yeah, and of course they're all on Garage Inc., but, you know, in those 4 or 5 years in between, I had that import. It was like a...
It was all red.
It was all red. It was an
Until It Sleeps single.
And it had...
They released like 3 Until It Sleeps singles, each with one or two of them on there, and then they released one single with all of them.
Yeah, they called it the whole Motorheadache mess. Yeah, and it had like an embossed... like a raised sort of cover.
Like cardboard digipack.
Yeah, it was fancy.
I have that.
I believe it had a fold-out poster of them dressed as the Lemmys inside.
I actually bought that, and then I realized that there were these singles, and I had to buy them. So I probably spent, like, you know, like somewhere in the upwards of, like, you know, $150 on just load era stuff. Yeah,
dude, I chased all that stuff in the 90s. I was just talking about this with who was on one of the guests I had on recently. Doc Coyle, I think. I was explaining to him the Outlaw Torn Unencumbered by Manufacturing version.
Absolutely. On the Memory Remains Part 2.
Yeah. A title that just rolls off the tongue.
Yeah, absolutely. They couldn't have figured out a better way.
Which I feel like was intentional. Mind you, that's
my favorite song of the 90s.
Same here.
For Metallica, by far. Yeah. And I was so excited to get that, and then I realized it was really nothing. But
like, right. Well, maybe since you even remember which version of which single it was included on, you might know this because Doc asked me this, and I actually didn't remember, and I need to look it up, or perhaps you can tell me what is the actual. I know it's shorter, but how did they shorten it?
I think it's just the ending. If I recall correctly, because I haven't looked at it. I haven't listened to it in some time. But from what I recall, the note in the single said something to the effect of, basically, if we had gone over like a certain X amount of time
on the actual load CD. I know, because you couldn't fit that much music on the physical limitations of an actual CD.
Right. I think it was just the end solo was cut down a little bit, like the outro. I think they just faded it out. Like a minute early.
The Outlaw Torn and Bleeding Me are top 15, possibly top 10 Metallica songs, period, for me.
I'll tell you what, I put Outlaw Torn solidly in my top 5.
Wow.
Absolutely.
Intense.
Bleeding Me definitely rounds out a top 10. Now, mind you, I have to put this out there, though, that like I've also listened to Metallica so damn much that I won't listen to some classic songs. You know what I mean? Like, I've gotten to the point where I never need to listen to, say, a For Whom the Bell Tolls again. You know, matter of fact, if it comes on, I skip it.
You know what? Doc made that point where we were talking about how, you know, at any Metallica concert, obviously you're going to hear Enter Sandman, Nothing Else Matters, probably Seek and Destroy, For Whom the Bell Tolls, Creeping Death, Master of Puppets. There's songs that, like, you're always going to hear one. And Doc was saying he would pay twice as much to go to a Metallica show that's everything else. You know, that doesn't have those songs, just so there's more room for the deeper cuts.
Yeah, I mean, that was why I was really upset that I didn't get to go to any of those anniversary shows, because it was like, man, I would kill to hear Carpe Diem, Baby.
Right, right.
You know what I mean? Like, I mean, with the exception of, like, the ridiculous Lulu songs that they played, like, there was just, like, those deep cuts are always the ones I always gravitated towards. You know, like I said, like, I did get to see the Outlaw Torn live, which was great, you know, but... Man, I would love to see, you know, poor Twisted Me.
Yeah, I mean, when they did Bleeding Me at the anniversary shows, if you watch that on YouTube, you see Hetfield get this, like, little supercharge at the end where he's like, yeah, like, that's a really good song. Almost like he kind of forgot, you know, like, wait, that's a great song.
On Load Tour, I remember they did play it a couple times, and actually, oddly enough, I went to all 3 Chicago shows on the first Load Tour, because it was, I'll never forget, it was February 7th, 8th, and 9th, and my birthday is the 10th.
Amazing.
So between my parents and my sister and my friends, they all got me tickets for all 3 nights. So I went all 3 nights. And I know I think it was the second night they put that song in the set list. And it was like an alternate song. So like they played like someplace twice that would pop in there. You know, and then the third night is when they played Fuel, but it's Fuel for Fire, with the original version with different lyrics.
Oh, wow.
Which, mind you, I bootlegged. So I have a copy of that actual thing that I recorded. I recorded all 3 nights of that tour.
See, one of the difficulties with double albums, whether it's a Use Your Illusion 1 and 2, you know, separate release sort of thing, or, you know, certainly something like Load and Reload, where it was conceived as a double album and then ended up being released separately, people assume, you know, oh, Load and Reload. Reload must be the leftovers, you know. And that's certainly not the case. I mean, Load has, Reload has some very strong tracks as well. And there's definitely an argument to be made, like Use Your Illusion, that there's a much better single album than a double album.
I definitely say that all the time. I think I did at one point say that I like Reload better than Load. I now realize the error of my ways in that, as there is definitely a lot more like, what the fuck is
Load has Outlaw Torn, Load has King Nothing.
Bleeding Me. It has 2x4 in the House that Jack Built, which I put real high up there. Poor Twisted Me. Ooh, I love that jam.
I would have fallen in love with Load much sooner, because I was one of those fans that kind of dismissed it early on and then went back to it and fell in love. Had they not opened with Ain't My Bitch.
I always say that that doesn't make my cut.
No, me neither. And
100% of the time.
And to have that kick off that whole era was... Ooh.
It was dicey. I mean, not to mention that, like, it just seems so damn ham-fisted. You know, you didn't really know what the hell they were talking about. The song itself is pretty cool if you take away the Ain't My Bitch part.
Right.
You know, it was just so out of nowhere, man. You know, like, it's not necessarily a bad riff. I do think that pre-chorus kills.
It's even, either the pre-chorus or the chorus has some of that, you know, Hetfield right hand, I'm air guitaring right now as I'm saying it.
Oh yeah, totally.
You know, like fast picking, like it's.
Yeah, there are some jamming moments, but then he says, "Ain't my bitch," and it's a weird thing, man. You know, like oddly enough, I know it's a huge song, too. And I'll tell you what, I often, like I said earlier, like I often say that people overlook the fact that that is some of the best lyrical Hetfield shit.
Oh, for sure. I mean, he really found his voice. You know,
yeah, absolutely,
literally and figuratively, I think, with Bob Rock. I mean, during the Black Album
and Load and Reload. Him talking about his father passing away, which is something I've dealt with in the last couple of years, it's very relatable, too. And I think everybody can relate to it if you have lost a parent, too. You know, and you can see his, like, you know, his, like, kind of, like, you can feel he's in pain, man. You know, and, like, I honestly don't get that from Master of Puppets. I don't get that from Injustice for All. He's not talking from the heart. You know, and I think that that is like always, I can always relate to a more personal record.
Those earlier records are more storytelling, which have their own type of intensity and their own art to it.
Absolutely.
But yeah, from Black Album onward, you are really getting like a personal, visceral, sing your life, James Hetfield. And I think he's very good at it. He's very good at
absolutely
putting himself under the microscope. And it only became more and more intensified as it continued forward beyond there. I mean, yeah, and as you said, you know, as someone who lost a parent, I lost a parent very young, and, you know, songs like The God That Failed, I mean, they're so intense in that sense.
Yeah, they're heavy, man. It's heavy stuff, dude, you know? And, like, you know, and obviously as he's gotten older and sober and et cetera, he tries to go back to those points. As far as, I think he should be storytelling again, is what basically what I'm trying to say. Is I don't really know if he's getting the same sort of personal intensity as he was in, like, what was that, like, his early 30s, right?
Well, I love Hardwired, and one of the things I love about it is that he went back to the vocal harmonies from the Black Album and the Load era, but against the backdrop,
yeah, that's a thing,
of the more, you know, technical and aggressive sound musically.
I just think his lyrics are falling flat. I mean, I can make the same argument on Reload. You know, like Mansions in Memory Remains. You know, I mean, Mansions. It's Mansions, bro. All right, like just stop. God, do I hate that? You know, like, and then
I
you
love
know,
that song. What, though. I like the lyrics.
I do
that song.
Too. Yeah. I do too. But Mansions just drives me bonkers. I mean, what doesn't kill you, make you more strong, kills me every time. Yeah, I'm just like, God.
That one's a little rough. I mean, nothing really tops I Am the Table, which I didn't.
I don't know what you're talking about. I've absolutely completely written off that entire 2 years. That never happened, all right? You know, it's like, that's like the Star Wars prequels to me. They never happened.
I've said this many times on the podcast, so I'll make it brief. I don't reject the notion that when, you know, an important figure like Lou Reed says, let's make something together. Yeah, explore it, do it. I mean, I'm not a Lou Reed fan, so it's a little harder for me to relate to, but sure. What I think should have happened is you make the record, you put it on a shelf, it goes in the vault, and someday when Metallica's in that legacy artist Elvis Tupac realm, it's this curiosity of like
Tupac realm.
Of like, hey, did you know once upon a time Metallica made this weird German art concept record, you know?
I mean, you know, you're talking to the dude that made a black metal record with Thurston Moore.
Exactly. You know? Thank
so,
you.
No arguments here.
Hey, you put it out.
I did. Yeah, I totally did. And yeah, I think it's a little bit better than Lulu. I'm going to throw that out there. Yeah. But then again, I'm not one here to, you know, to pat myself on the back.
You are not the table.
No, I am not the table. No. Although I did send my girlfriend a Valentine's while I've been on tour this last little bit that was, you are my table. And as a picture of James Hetfield.
Oh, so, wow. See, I mean,
well, that's so sweet.
Even in the more difficult moments to process. And you know what? and this is something I talked about with Alex Skolnick. Alex argues that, and he doesn't like the record, but he argues that releasing it was part of the art of it, that it was almost intentionally challenging, and that we're not necessarily supposed to like it.
Okay, I respect Alex Skolnick, don't get me wrong. All right, and I respect everyone's opinion because we all have them, and I have my own lame brain opinions, okay? But just to draw like a little bit of an analogy here, I just recently saw Mother by Darren Aronofsky, and I'm a huge fan of Darren Aronofsky. Uh-huh. That movie fucking sucked. I don't care what anybody says about it. It was awful, okay? And just because it's art doesn't mean it's good. You know, and I think that people are a little bit too wrapped up and like, oh, well, it's arty. Maybe you just don't get it. It's like, no, dude, I get it. All right. You know, the entire movie is an allegory for the Bible. I get it, man. It doesn't mean it was good. You know, just because Radiohead released an album and it's arty doesn't mean it's good. You know, and I think people are a little bit, maybe people are not so afraid to talk shit about Metallica being artists, but.
Yeah. So sometimes we are too forgiving. I mean, my argument with Radiohead is that people that praise Kid A are people that got swept up in the momentum of how incredible OK Computer was and were ready to anoint whatever came next as godlike and willfully force themselves into pretending that that era of Radiohead wasn't garbage.
See, now the funny thing is that Radiohead, or I'm sorry, a Kid A and Amnesia are my favorite Radioheads, but it's also because I really got into psychedelic drugs around then. So on that note, I have to lean on my drug use. So I can't argue that, you know?
I love it. So what was your take on, you know, obviously, you know, people are throwing up in their mouths hearing all of our massive praise for Load and Reload. What was your take on Hardwired?
Oh, I really liked it. I thought it was good. My real question here to pose with current Metallica is, we all know, or maybe we don't know, so maybe I'll educate a few of you guys out there. You know that Dr. Dre didn't write the lyrics for a lot of 2001.
Sure. Including, or the Chronic, for that matter.
Or the Chronic, yeah. We're talking about songs, talking about how he is still Dr. Dre. He didn't write those lyrics. Mm. Now, my thought is why can't the most successful rock band in the world maybe have some dudes come in there helping write some songs? Mm. You know, because if anything, why isn't it down to like, hey, listen, can you guys, like, can someone just edit this for us? I feel like they're a little bit surrounded with Yes Men. When at this point in the game, I don't know, they're willing to write a record with Lou Reed. Why aren't they willing to let some guys edit them a little bit? Because that's really my argument with them. Actually, more with Death Magnetic, I could say. Editing them down a little bit would have really helped that record. And I even think it could have still helped on Hardwire, you know?
Well, and I'm with you, certainly with Saint Anger, that record.
100%.
I mean, obviously, there's a lot of things that it needs. But editing, I think, is the... If you were to pin it down to one thing that would salvage it, I would say editing. It just needs...
Absolutely.
And not even just that the songs are too long, but that they're...
Oh, they're too long.
They're absolutely
too long. The thing is that, you know, it's funny because I think that they were like, when they put out Saint Anger, they're like, oh, yeah, man, the songs are long again. It's like, yeah, but you guys had like 8,000 riffs and they were opuses. You know, they were like melodic acoustic breakdowns with double leads. You guys are playing nu metal riffs for 8 minutes.
And they're just sort of haphazardly stitched together in a computer.
Absolutely. And like, don't get me wrong, I think that that's not necessarily a thing you can really frown at nowadays, you know, but it was haphazardly done, not flawlessly done.
Right.
You know what I mean?
Whereas, yeah, a song like To Live, you know, To Live Is To Die or And Justice For All are long, epic tracks, but they take you on a journey that sort of makes sense. There's a destination. There's moods and textures and tones. And I mean, look, I certainly argued that Saint Anger was necessary. It saved the band.
I think it was, too.
And it's interesting.
A necessary evil is what it was.
Amen.
That helps me sleep at night thinking that.
I think Death Magnetic, which is a record that I absolutely love, would have benefited from some vocal harmonies.
Yeah.
Some double track vocals. And, you know, as people, of course, complain about the mix and moreover the mastering. I'm not so hung up on that, but I think
I'm not either, to be honest with you. I think that everyone getting on that was a bunch of people. Like, I think there's a definite argument for it, but I think a lot of people getting behind that don't even know what the fuck mastering is. Because let me tell you something, I've done a lot of recording and a lot of mastering, and mastering me just means it's loud enough. All right,
right.
So I don't believe half of these people be like, the mastering is terrible. It's like, shut up.
Doc Coyle made that same point. Like, come on, bro, quit trying to, you know. It's like a lot of people when you hear them talking about film and they're like, I think the movie really struggles in the third act. A lot of those people, I want to stop and go, can you explain to me definitively where each act begins and ends in this film?
Absolutely, yeah.
Or is that just something you say?
Film school too, you know, like I hear that shit all the time. I'm like, you know what the hell you're talking about. You know, like, because sometimes I don't know what the third act is. I studied film, you know, like, so suck it. No way.
But yeah, I feel like Hardwired fixed a lot of the kind of quibbles that I had with Death Magnetic.
Me too. Yeah, it's definitely the best Metallica record since Load.
For
how about
sure.
that?
For
you know,
sure.
Well, maybe since Reload. Because Reload is definitely the weaker of the two, 100%. And I would definitely take less songs off of Reload than I would Load. You know what I mean?
So let's do this while I've got you. This will be a good kind of last thing to do before we wrap up and I let you go to soundcheck. I've got the track listing for Load and Reload open in front of me. You're the guy to do this with. You tell me.
I'll keep
my opinions out of it for the most part. Let's hear what your, ultimate Load, Reload mix would be. Here's what I'll do.
I got to pull this up really quick myself, right? So I have it up here so I can look.
Well, I was going to say, you can pull it up, but I was also going to suggest that I can just go track by track and you can just give me a pass fail, like a yes or no.
Yeah, let's do that. That'll be easier.
So.
Yeah, absolutely. Let's do it like that.
Ain't My Bitch. Is that on there or not?
Gone.
Gone.
Absolutely gone.
2x4.
Stays. If you ever heard that Castle Donington from 95 bootleg version of this song, you will agree with me too, because that shit was heavy.
This is why I love you, because I always tell people, like, look, like when Saint Anger comes up, I go, hey, check out the acoustic Bridge School Benefit version of All Within My Hands.
Exactly.
Then you'll feel like that's an awesome song, because that rendition of it is killer.
Or the original Bridge School Benefit show where they played Low Man's Lyric. Fantastic.
Oh, yeah. But Low Man's Lyric, I back the studio version, too.
Yeah, me too.
Okay, so I know you're going to say yes to The House That Jack Built.
Absolutely. One of my favorites.
So here's a controversial song, Until It Sleeps.
Love it. I think that video is great, too. I love how moody it is. You know, like, there's just, like, that song rules. Weird when I first came out, and they were wearing eyeliner, and, like, Kirk was getting covered in gold paint. I don't know. You know, it was really weird for me, especially being like 13 when that record came out, I think, or something like that. Like, you know, you're in an odd part of life, and there was like some weirdness to it. But looking back, man, is that a well-constructed song? It's different, which is something that, like, I feel as though, I appreciate, you know, like a different, you know, a sound from a band I know. It was great. I love experimenting. So going back to that, absolutely.
I'm with you on all of that, including the video. I know Hetfield's probably not a fan of the video nowadays. And I know,
yeah, he looked good in the video though, man.
I agree. And dude,
harsh in that era.
And when it kicks into the performance part, and he's got the Explorer, and they look awesome.
Yeah, you know? they look bad.
Blending sort of all
about.
Of it. Yeah, and I think that I want to say, I don't want to put words in his mouth, of course, but I want to say that's the song that Newstead has expressed misgivings about. But I love
really
it.
Okay, that's weird.
And yeah, I mean, dude, they were. I always say that Metallica in the 90s were being true to themselves just like they were in the 80s. It just so happened in the 90s they were listening to Alice in Chains and Thin Lizzy and Soundgarden.
Oh, yo, dude, it's COC, Deliverance by Metallica.
So, King Nothing.
King Nothing stays.
I love it. I love it. It's
love
one,
it dude,
and I love that video.
I do too, and I tried. I can't tell you how many guitar pedals I bought around this era to try to emulate that first note that Kurt's playing.
Wow.
You know, I tried everything to do that. I still don't know how he makes it sound like that. It's awesome.
And I've always wanted to make a music video in the snow ever since that video.
Yeah, me too, but it's never going to happen because I'm a total wuss. Sounds like a guy who's born and raised in Chicago. It's never happened.
So here's a controversial song, Hero of the Day.
I'm going to pass on this, and it's simply for time. Because if we got to be real about this, right?
Because, dude,
like,
the song turns into Ride the Lightning at the end, which people don't realize.
It does, totally.
You know?
It does, yeah. But I got to do it like this, all right? Whenever I've done this, and obviously you know that I've done this a bunch. I think you and I have had this conversation before.
We have.
Like,
but,
yeah,
not,
okay,
but, not,
so
but,
like,
but not for the masses like we are right now.
Yeah, not officially. So I always say that you can't go past 14 songs. Like, I'm not going to sit here and crunch numbers with time of the tracks, right? But, you know, you can't go past 14. Load at 14. So you got to keep it at 14. So, unfortunately, in that regard, I got to let Hero of the Day.
I got you. Because, you know, I like the song too, but I could see, especially if we were making a mix to try to kind of convert some disbelievers in this era.
Absolutely. Hero of the Day would be a song that I would put on, and I know that someone would be like, oh, this song? Give me a break. A lot of people like King Nothing. You know, I've met a lot of people that are, like, pretty much load haters. Like, oh, well, King Nothing's okay.
So Bleeding Me is 1,000% on this.
Absolutely. Like I said, I'm picking the two longest songs off this record. So, like I said, I'm not going to crunch numbers here for track listings or anything, but, you know, that already is 18 minutes of music.
Indeed.
So
Bleeding Me, what about Cure?
So I used to love this one growing up, not so much in my later age. So I'm going to let it go.
Poor Twisted Me. You've already talked about your love for that.
Love that one. Yeah, that. Now, this is the one that I didn't like when it came out. Now I've grown to be obsessed with it. I love that song.
Are you going to waste your hate?
I am going to not waste my hate and let that one go to the wayside. I used to love this one. And it was a staple of the time, live set-wise, too. And I remember a lot of people, this is another one, people were like, oh, man, that's a pretty good song, even though the rest of the album sucks.
Yeah.
And I thought that, too. And I don't know. No, I don't really like it.
It's got some riffs, but yeah, I hear you.
It does have some riffs, but that doesn't mean that they're not Bleeding Me riffs.
I'll tell you. You know? I wish James Hetfield would make a Mama Said style solo album.
You know what, dude? I would probably buy it. I will keep Mama Said.
I was going to say, I don't know that it belongs on a Metallica album, but I like it.
I like it. How about this? Here we go, getting deep again. The Jules Holland 1996 performance of Just Hetfield and an acoustic guitar. Tell me that's not awesome.
And you know, and you know, one of the reasons we love each other. I am familiar. Yes. I am familiar with
you
that.
Know exactly
of which you speak.
Yes, and that is what I'm talking about, man. That is what is up. And so, if I can say, I'd really like a solo acoustic version of that song on the record.
Indeed.
Without the country western part, even though I'm a fan of the country western part. Just doesn't really fit for Metallica. You know what I mean?
So, would you advocate pulling it from this mix?
How about that? Yeah, let's pull it just to be fair.
I would pull it even just because you don't want somebody to give up on the whole thing.
Right, exactly.
Thorn Within.
Yes. Absolutely.
I
love that song.
Thorn Within.
Yeah, it's great. That's awesome. And I love the Stone Temple Pilots riff.
Ooh, good call.
It's totally Six Times Thin.
Yeah, dude, wow, you're right. It's so
90s. Yeah, it 100% is. It's so 90s. It's great. And from the 90s.
Ronnie, that's definitely a controversial one.
Yeah, you know, I loved this one. Loved this one, but I don't think it fits on Metallica. I don't think it fits with Metallica, unfortunately.
And again, cutting for time to try to trim this.
Yeah, 14 minutes. I mean, 14 songs is what I'm going for. And I think I got, like, what, six right now? I think I do, right? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 with Thorn Within. And I'm going Outlaw Torrance. I'm at 8. Outlaw Torn is my track one.
Yeah, I was gonna say, yeah, we sequencing is a whole
other that's a whole other thing.
So Fuel.
I'm gonna go pass on Fuel, honestly. Controversial.
And I feel like knowing you, as much as I love this song, especially live, I think you're gonna pass on Memory Remains.
No, I'm going with Memory Remains. There's another song that I tried to emulate that high note thing with pedals, could never get it. You know, Dance Little Tin Goddess, right? You know, could never figure out how they got that sound. Amazing guitar effects on this, both of these records, in all honesty. There's some really, killer guitar effects on this. I think people totally overlook.
Well, and I think people, when you look at these two records, there's a lot of Hammett co-writes, which isn't something you see a lot of.
Absolutely.
Devil's Dance.
Absolutely. There's another one from Donington before the year before Load came out. That I thought that song was, it's way heavier back then. I think they were just, you know, maybe they were just still metal band then when they were playing them. But man, dig it.
Yeah, that was one of the ones that they broke out.
Early. It was that and 2x4.
Unforgiven 2. I'm a fan. I know most people aren't. I'm a fan. I celebrate the whole trilogy.
I definitely celebrate the first two. And I'm going to leave it on. I really love that D-Bender Telecaster guitar part. I think that was great. Did Kirk Hammett blow this song at the American Music Awards when they played it live the one time? And I think, he screwed the pooch on that one. And I'll tell you what, that song has never recovered, I think, in the eyes of themselves. But I thought it was a fantastic rendition. Really strong chorus, too. To this day, right now it's already stuck in my head. That's going to be in there for a week. Love it.
Oh, yeah. And when we were talking about Hetfield as a lyricist, I mean, that's like a top
five. It's killer. Absolutely. Yeah, he killed it.
Better Than You.
I'm Letting It Go. Not my favorite. This is like the song that you can make the argument that these were Load B-sides. You know what I mean? Like, this is the one where you're like, wait a minute, maybe these weren't supposed to be a record, you know?
It's, that song's a little undercooked as Metallica.
And it's 5.5 minutes. I'm looking at it right now. It seems insanely long.
Slither.
Also gonna Let It Go.
And I know you like Carpe Diem, baby.
Ooh, yeah, that's my shit. That's a weird song, man. Real creepy, too.
I remember reading that Newstead was really uncomfortable with the word baby in a Metallica song.
I remember that, too. And I remember thinking that, like, I remember Hetfield's response was that it had some cockiness to it, which I think kind of has always been a thing that I support. You know, a little Han Solo never hurt anybody.
Indeed. Are you ready to choke on a Bad Seed? Mm-hmm.
Okay, so I have to point out here that one of my other all-time favorite bands is Nick Cave and the Bad Seeds. And I knew that he named the song after them. And I do really love this riff. I'll be honest with you that it is a song that I don't think I have heard in a long time. And I think for the sake of the hell of it, I'm going to say, yeah, let's keep it.
Yeah, you know what? I don't think I've heard it in a long time either, because right now I can only sort of remember.
Right, yeah. You know what? I think that after I get off of this and I go soundtrack, I'm going to listen to it to make sure I'm okay with it. But I'm going to go with Bad Seed right now. I'm going to go with it.
What about Where the Wild
negative.
Things Are?
Strong.
That was a hard
this
pass.
This goes along the lines of both Slither and Better Than You, where I'm just like, wait, what is this? The riff seems lopsided. The lyrics are really fucking bizarre. It doesn't sound like a song. It sounds like one of those ideas that should have been put aside. You know, like what it sounds like all the stuff that you hear on some kind of monster in that jam room before Hetfield goes to rehab.
You know what's interesting about Where the Wild Things Are is it's the only Newstead co-write.
I don't believe that those co-writes are totally indicative of who had anything to do with those songs, though. You know what I mean? Because like I know that like at one point someone asked in one of the Metallica magazines for the fan club, how does one get a writing credit in Metallica? And Jason Newsted's response was, write a song with a different band. Which I thought was, like, harsh as hell. And this is before he was gone, you know? So, like, I remember reading that and being like, ooh, that's not good. Like, that's pretty right.
Oh, man. Yeah, and that's a whole other topic when we talk
about
this.
We can do a part two.
About this. Well, yeah, because when we talk about this Kill 'Em All credits.
Oh, right. Jesus.
So, Prince Charming.
Nope, sucks. Goodbye. I really feel like all the songs I'm picking are the ones that are like, yep, that's a. I mean, Fuel, I'm just letting go because I loved it, but it's just like, You know, like I said, once I saw it in that car commercial, it really
hurt me, and also, if we were going to, if the idea is that, which I think it should be, that we're going to present this to a Metallica fan who's dismissed that this era of the band, they've certainly heard Fuel already, and they know where they stand on
that's,
it.
So. If that's the purpose of this, then the both track ones are garbage. You know, like...
So that leaves us with three more songs, Low Man's Lyric.
Which is definitely on. Gotta go with Low Man's Lyric, you know? Especially if I'm cutting off Mama Said. Gotta go with Low Man's Lyric. That's my ballad, man.
And then we've got I'll Love It. And that's the song you and I have always, one of the songs you and I have always talked about covering together.
It's so true, yes.
And then Attitude and Fixer.
So Attitude, I'm also nixing. You know, once again, really dug it when it came out. I thought it was one of the stronger tracks. Truthfully, I think it falls right back into the better than you category. You know, it's like, it's kind of like whatever. It's kind of a punk rocky song, though, which I do enjoy.
What's interesting about this editing that we're doing is that as a hardcore fan, I love having a catalog with so much density and diversity to it that we've heard those songs and that we know them. And yet, if trying to edit sort of like a perfect load reload, that's a song I would.
Yeah, that's a total song. It's interesting, absolutely.
Because losing it doesn't mean I don't.
Not at all. I mean, we're just like facing the fact that maybe this whole editing thing goes back to '96. You know, like maybe someone should have been like, "Hey guys, like let's not do Use Your Illusions 1 and 2. That shit didn't sell that well." You know what I mean? Like, you know.
Maybe someone says, hey, maybe all your B-sides don't have to be covers and demos.
Yeah.
Maybe, like, have actual, you know, maybe Where the Wild Things Are is an actual.
To be honest with you, dude, I mean, if you looked at, if we kept Load as is and then threw something like A Memory Remains as a B-side, how much would we be freaking out about that?
It's something to consider for sure.
Yeah. So, and Fixer, by the way.
So we're losing.
Absolutely.
Makes it.
That's another one of my favorites from this era, especially towards the end of that breakdown when it comes back in and like it's just Hetfield's vocals for that line and then it kicks back into the chorus. Oh man, I love that. It gets me every time.
And that's another Kirk Hammett co-writer.
Man, Hammett killed it in this era if you ask me.
Hammett's all over this. He's so just kind of looking at the songwriting credits real quick. Kirk is credited on Fuel. He's credited first.
Weird.
Actually, he's credited on the Unforgiven 2, on Slither, Carpe Diem Baby, Bad Seed, and Fixer.
Yeah, well, dude, Fixer was the jam, dude. Yeah, all those like backwards guitar stuff. You know, I also recall them as opening up all the Load shows with a jam, and it was always Bad Seed when I saw them. Or Better Than You, actually, was another one.
I also remember that era is when they were doing the medleys of the early records, which I think pissed a lot of people off.
Yeah, they would walk out there with the lights still up, though.
Yeah, or when I saw them do like acoustic Kill 'Em All songs.
Yeah, well, on Reload, they were doing the little acoustics, and they were doing like the Four Horsemen, but it was like a two-step. That was pretty fun, if you ask me. People hated it.
Yeah, and it was like the whole stage was gone, but there was like a little light bulb.
Absolutely, which, mind you, I saw that. Now, that was, what, 98 on that tour? I saw that happen in 1996, once again, on the Stone Temple Pilots tour for Tiny Music. They did the same thing. They had an entire second set come down from above the stage with a bunch of pillows and shit. And
I love Stone Temple
Pilots.
Yeah,
me too.
Kirk Hammett is credited on 2x4, The House That Jack Built, King Nothing, Hero of the Day, and Bleeding Me, which are three singles from that record. Wasting My Hate, Thorn Within.
Man.
Yeah, he's all over.
I am clearly a Hammett dude. You know, I've owned two different Kirk Hammett ESP signature guitars over my time. You know, I've always been a Hammett guy, even though I'm a Hetfield dude. I'm a Hammett guy.
And interestingly, because we all know, of course, Newstead has a riff in Blackened, and I believe he's got at least one co-write on the Black album. I don't think he has anything on Load.
No, I don't think so. Like, I think it was just Where the Wild Things Are, and I want to say on the Black album it is My Friend of Misery.
I'm gonna look that up right now. Actually, and
damn,
you are correct.
My knowledge goes
deep. I'm not surprised that you are correct.
Well, you know, the thing is, that it's like this is a song that starts with a bass solo. You know, that isn't really harkened back in the song at all. You know what I'm saying? Like, this, I feel as though they were like, yeah, that thing sounds cool. Let's put it at the start, and then we'll have you do it in the middle, and I'll just want to crap over it. You know, like, very
Kirk,
separate.
Kirk shows up more on the Black album than I realized. I mean, of course,
Enter Sandman.
The Enter Sandman riff. But he's also credited on The Unforgiven, Through the Never, and Of Wolf and Man.
You know, I mean, I've had this argument just recently about how that second half of the Black Album is nearly flawless. You take away, like, all the singles, I think that record's incredible, looking back at it.
Dude, I love every single song on that record, unashamedly. Which was interesting, and it's funny, when David Olufsen was on, he said he likes the first half of the record.
Well, they are great singles.
Yeah, I mean, and he was talking about how they were inescapable with Mandatory Metallica on the radio and all that sort of thing.
So. I did win one of those contests.
Tell me, okay, let's end with that. Tell me about that.
they were giving away like a double disc thing that had it was called Mandatory Metallica. It was like a double disc set, and
it was on Rock
103.5 in Chicago. And during Mandatory Metallica, they played three songs at, like, whatever, 10 or 11 o'clock. You had to call in and name the three songs. And I remember it was definitely Stone Dead Forever was one of them. And I called in. And then, like, basically they had a bunch of winners. Everybody got the CD. And then one was chosen to come down and host Mandatory Metallica one night. I did not win that, but I did win. And I got the double disc Mandatory Metallica CD. And it was like Greatest Hits, more or less what it was.
Well, you are a winner on Speak and Destroy.
Thank you for having me. I'm glad to for be a winner sure. here yet again.
I'll be having you back, of course. And,
yeah. We'll have to go over some other things. I feel like there's more to cover.
The Atlas Moth can be found on all of the usual places on social media. I'd suggest starting on their Facebook page. You can also find Speak and Destroy on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter, where I assure you we aren't just constantly promoting the episodes. We've been posting rare and interesting bits from across the spectrum of Metallica's history. If you're enjoying Speak and Destroy, please, the best thing you can do right now is to go into iTunes or wherever you consume podcasts and leave us a 5-star rating and a nice review. The more of these we get, the higher the visibility for the podcast and the more people may discover it. You can find me on Twitter at Ryan Downey and on Instagram at SuperheroHQ. If you're in the LA area, I'll be at the Musicians Institute on Thursday, February 22nd, hosting a Q&A with Alter Bridge singer Miles Kennedy. Speak and Destroy is part of the Pop Curse Podcast Network. As always, you guys have been great, and I've been Ryan J. Downey.